Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Jay.
It's Rebooting the News number 57. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Jay.
It's just you and me.
It's kind of quiet here. It's like the kids left home, right?
And our engineer, Adrian.
Adrian, yeah. Adrian asked on the way in, who are you going to torture this week?
Just the listeners.
And I said, no, it's torture you. Yeah, well, it's good not to have a guest every once in a while.
We did want to comment a bit on our two previous guests, Rizziotti and Brendan Greeley. I think they deserve a bit of a roundup, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I think those were two of our best shows.
Me too.
Especially the one on with Ziadi.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific.
Because I think we sort of nailed... that was right at the intersection of Rebooting the News. It's like all the politics, the economics, the technology of it, all that, all sitting in one place. And,
right.
And I think, you know, there's a secret sitting there available for anybody who wants it, that there's sort of a new way to do things which may not be... You know, may not be run by Apple or Twitter or whatever. Maybe just the open.
Right. Yeah,
maybe just the open web will be good enough for us. That's what we're hoping, right?
And this tension between the open web and another way of doing things came out fully in Rebooting the News number 55 with Rizziotti.
Mm-hmm. And then 56 was an outgrowth of the no interviews thing.
Yeah. You don't do interviews, Dave. Why not?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I wrote a piece about that and got a little bit of flack over it, which was not unexpected. Why? Because I don't see why I should do interviews. It's the other way around. I mean, you know, back when I was a CEO of a company and promoting products, there was kind of, you know, I felt I had to do interviews because that was how I got exposure.
You needed press.
I had a business model for mm-hmm. it. It was a way to make money doing it. And, you know, so, sure. And that was before I had a blog, pretty much, too.
Right.
And a way to publicize my own products. Because later, I was still doing interviews when I started blogging. But it didn't... The interviews weren't helping me sell the product. I was selling the product by writing to the people who would be interested. You know, my focus was in that certain area, a certain type of people. That's what I was writing was interesting to those people. Mm-hmm. So they were coming to me, reading my blog and buying my software. And I don't think that the publicity, I think I was one of those guys that they don't feel they need to stroke me to get access. So, you know, the press never really did help me all that much, you know.
Right.
Because
you were explaining what you were doing anyway on your blog, so why do I need secret access to your plans?
Well, it's not that. That would be attributing to them a little bit more honesty than I think. I think that they just didn't feel like I'm not honesty isn't the right word. I'm just not that big a product, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have to have Steve Jobs.
Sure.
If you don't get invited to the Apple rollout, you're
right.
Nobody, right?
Right.
Do you need to have access to Dave Weiner?
No.
I don't think anybody feels that they need to have access to me. So consequently, they need to have somebody that they can kick in the butt. And so I'm the kind of person they would kick in the butt. You know?
So you stopped doing interviews because you found that you didn't need it, and because...
I couldn't see a reason why I should do it. I wasn't doing anything in service of the truth. Let's put it that way.
Was it painful?
I wouldn't say painful. Painful in what sense? Like getting a root canal is painful? No.
Well,
but
when you see... what you're doing, what you're thinking, what your words are poorly reflected, isn't that painful?
Isn't it? I suppose. What do you think? Does it ever happen to you? Do you ever get quoted inaccurately?
Well, I stopped doing a particular kind of interview.
Did you?
Yes. Oh. I do not do broadcast interviews to be taped and put into a package and run on television, really? Whether it's documentaries or... like news reports.
Because
there is absolutely, it's what you're saying is there's no percentage in it for me. There's no gain. I have to devote an hour or two or half an hour or whatever. I tell them what I know and what I think.
And you end up
saying...
And
then it's edited into a soundbite that really is almost arbitrary as a selection from what I told them.
It's as if...
I have no control over that. And, of course, it's I wouldn't want control over it because that would be... That would ruin the independence of the journalist. But it's just absurd. It's an absurd ritual that just made less and less sense to me, especially when I try to get my ideas out in a nuanced and fully developed way. So it just became absurd after a while.
So why do any kind of interview then?
Well, I have more confidence.
What kind of interviews do you do? Let's put it that way.
Well, when reporters call me and they're writing stories and they don't require me to go into their studio and they don't have to bring their equipment into my office and disrupt, you know, my world for an hour, and they need guidance or they need quotes, or if I am asked to do something live where I can be myself on the air, then I will do it. And a lot of times, it's more useful for me and for the reporter to not even worry about being quoted, and which I think has happened to you too, and just sort of talk about the background of the story.
Those are my two exceptions, right?
Yeah.
I'm willing, if I'm interested, I will talk on background, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then because it's in those terms where I can't be quoted, then it's more like two equals talking about something, and I can ask them questions too. And,
right.
So we're like peers, and I'm happy to do that if I'm interested.
Right.
And so there's something I might get out of it that way. The other one is I like live radio.
Live radio is great
because
like what we're doing here,
right? Because there's no editing.
Yeah.
And so you get to go.
Yeah. I like talking to journalists most of the time, and I learn from it in the sense that because I study what they do, I'm very interested in the way that they frame questions, the way they determine what an issue is. I'm kind of a student of how complex and fluid developments get shaped into a story, and it's really good to study the way story sort of comes at you and the questions of a reporter trying to complete one. So most of the time I enjoy it, and I do a lot of them. But frequently I have to say to reporters, actually, I don't know anything about that, or I don't know enough about that, or I don't know enough to have a distinct view that would really add anything. And I decline, which they actually appreciate. So I'm on pretty good terms with most journalists. But broadcasts, forget it. And these documentaries that want you to come to their studio and spend 2-3 hours of your day, and then months later, maybe 6-7 months later, you're in the interview for like 25 seconds. And to them, that's totally normal. That's the way documentaries are done. And to me, it just seems absurd. But transitioning to Brendan Greeley, the reason we had Brendan Greeley, who's a technology writer for The Economist, on was that he wanted to interview you. So you said what?
I suggested that maybe we could do the interview in this context.
Mm-hmm.
And because I thought Brendan, of all the people I know, would be the kind of person who would go for that, because Brendan has a radio background.
Yes.
He worked with Chris Lydon.
On open source radio.
Right. Yeah. And Brendan and I have spent many hours talking about it, just shooting the shit, talking about stuff.
He's very into podcasting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a former colleague of mine, and you know, I liked him. I think hopefully the feeling's mutual. And I get a lot out of talking with him, so I thought he would be a good... And I was very pleased with the way it turned out. I mean, it was funny, because at one point we realized he was just basically running the show.
Yes.
And it was fine. I mean, he did a good job, and it was, you know, let's try something
new. We should
new,
think whatever. Of some... Maybe there might be another journalist who like to do that. That might be an interesting way of...
I would love to do that periodically. Yeah. It's a way to sort of tap into... I mean, it is, in a way, itself... rebooting the news, mm-hmm. itself. I mean, I think that you know, all these things are, we're where you're actually doing it instead of talking about it is more interesting.
So if you're a reporter and you're listening to this,
if you have an idea,
that
you might want to participate.
Brendan's idea came from his editor. I think blogging might be dying, his editor said.
Yeah, he denied that. Well, let's wait and see what actually comes out of the process.
Right. I haven't seen it. But anyway, that was the occasion. Yeah. It did work out well.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. Yeah.
Meanwhile, let's move on.
So, what about McChrystal? That was an interesting quick thing to talk about. I was really, really puzzled about how did that interview come about. Why did somebody in that position of power, where why did he end up saying something so boneheaded and stupid? So obviously insubordinate. The kinds of things he was saying were the things that he had to be fired for, right? I mean, you know, you could say that if your Secretary of Agriculture says stuff like that, maybe you could forgive it, but not a general. I mean, there you're talking about a general talking about somebody several levels up the chain of command from him. You know, you just don't have, you know, When generals do stuff like that, you're starting to think coup d'etat. You're starting to think this guy might, you know, try to run the country at some point, you know, at the force of a gun. So why did he do it?
And why did he do it?
Right. And so then I was listening to On the Media, and they provided a pretty good theory on it. And when I heard it, I thought, that's probably what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to your whole Church of the Savvy theory, is that he probably thought, you know, McChrystal clearly is a member of that club, right? I mean, he's the kind of guy who talks to reporters off the record all the time.
Yes.
And he might not have gotten an agreement with this guy. I think his name was Hastings or something.
Yes.
He might not have gotten an agreement. He might have just assumed that he had the agreement, that he was being treated off the record.
So lots of journalists asked the same question you did when this article appeared, which is, how did somebody as savvy as the commanding general of American troops in Afghanistan, has to be just to get to that position, allow a reporter to witness and report such things? How did that happen?
And the answer is, he's been doing it all along.
The answer,
this is nothing new.
Yeah, the answer is
he
probably
has his ass covered by
the beat reporters who follow McChrystal around or who report regularly on the Pentagon and the mission in Afghanistan are part of a tacit understanding that doesn't have to be spelled out, which is that when you're around military people in informal settings, it's understood to be off the record, because relationships of trust built up over time are necessary for those reporters to do their job. And Jamie McIntyre, who was for a long time CNN's military reporter, he's now out of the game, and he teaches at the University of Maryland.
I think he was the guy who was on the media.
Yeah. He, for example, observed that what his editors at CNN want from him, half of what they want from him, is that when something happens, when there's an event, when there's something, a rumor, when there's breaking news, they want to be able to go to McIntyre and say, find out if this is true.
Right.
Use your sources and get us inside the Pentagon. And in order for McIntyre to be able to do that on demand, as it were, he has to have a relationship already, right, with Pentagon people. And he can't have that if he's constantly undermining their attempts to control their image by talking about backstage behavior, essentially.
Right.
So Hastings, the freelance writer for Rolling Stone, had no investment like that. And therefore, he reported what he saw. And probably McChrystal and his aides assumed that he was part of the club.
Right. But McIntyre said something else when he was on the Media that I thought was worth mentioning here. Is that, and I don't remember the entire rationale for this, but he said basically that McChrystal was breaking the law when he was saying these things. That kind of insubordination of an active, you know, military commander against relative to his commander in chief is actually against the law. And he said that if he were in that situation, he would not have been able to protect him. And I didn't believe him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't believe him. I thought he was lying right there. And I thought, you know, because I'm familiar with this process inside the tech industry. And, you know, it goes to what I was saying before about, you know, how I'm the kind of guy that they will... I don't have that relationship with reporters where I'm allowed to go, you know, say things out of school you know, that don't get quoted, but I know other people do. I've seen it happen.
Sure.
And I sometimes wonder, why are they protecting this guy? I mean, this guy's, that's newsworthy, what he just said, you know, and because they get accustomed to being treated that way and being sloppy. But if it's breaking the law, I mean,
yeah.
I don't think this guy deserves that kind of protection. I think what Hastings did was admirable, and I think these guys ought to be careful. I think they really, you know,
meanwhile,
not feel that the press is so buddy-buddy with them, right?
Yes. It's important to keep those relationships
I think Frank
clear.
Rich was the guy who pointed out in his piece that while all this was going on, the CNN was planning... The whole White House dinner thing was going on, you know.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner,
right.
Yeah, which is the ultimate in clubby events.
And
in
Rolling Stone didn't have a pavilion there,
right?
And maybe Rolling Stone is doing a much better job. Maybe these guys ought to be paying attention to what Rolling Stone's doing.
Well, at the very least, what we have to say is that we're only going to get a complete picture if we have reporters on the inside and a lot of reporters on the outside. And it's definitely necessary for...
I'd like to have the reporters all be on the outside, Jay. I'm surprised to hear you say that, actually.
Well,
I always understood that you wanted the reporters to have the almost adversarial relationship with the people that they're covering.
I do. And I'm trying to make the best case I can for the traditional routines. I do feel that they have become, over time... corrupted, but I think also that a better relationship between beat reporters and sources is possible once people realize how badly the current system has served us, which is why I found it so significant, as did other outside observers like myself, when the Politico slipped into its account of this episode the following sentence: as a freelance reporter, Hastings would be considered a bigger risk to be given unfettered access compared with a beat reporter who would not risk burning bridges by publishing many of McChrystal's remarks. And the...
Wait, say that slowly. I didn't... So Politico had that sentence
in its
in
account.
A report. Say it, so could you I didn't have a chance to process it. Politico had this in their report,
yes.
But they took it out.
Yes,
they right?
later.
And what did the sentence say again?
The sentence says, by way of saying, how did McChrystal allow this to happen?
Okay.
They said Hastings would be considered a bigger risk to be given unfettered access compared with a beat reporter who would not risk burning bridges by publishing many of McChrystal's remarks.
A bigger risk to who?
To McChrystal.
And McChrystal didn't understand.
And he didn't understand that, or the people around him didn't understand that.
Okay. But they took that out.
And
why do you think they took it out?
Well, that was the question. Why did they take it out?
What do you think they took
And
it?
I wrote my post about it, and they had already told Columbia Journalism Review that they don't comment on editing decisions and go away, and we're not going to explain this. And so I said, all right, well, I'm going to write about this. And I did at my blog, Press Think. I stayed up until 2 in the morning to do it. And it started to get around the press world the next day. And in the middle of the day, I get a note from an editor of Politico saying, in a sort of chuckling tone, well, Jay, you know, I love conspiracies as much as the next person, and I love... When I was a press reporter, I loved to have a good gotcha. But in this case, the truth is just so mundane. I was editing this article, and we had new information to put in. And when I put the new information in, the thing got long and unwieldy, so I cut a bunch of stuff out. And that was just one of the things I cut out to make the piece more readable and shorter, because it was getting out of hand. And that's the story, and it's no big conspiracy.
I hate it when people use that word. It's like, because it's like a backhanded way of saying you're being paranoid. And,
yeah.
And it's a personal.
Well, I didn't say that it was a conspiracy. What I said was this is revealing. That's all.
Right. It's revealing, and it's also revealing that I'm assuming that this is the only place in the entire field of journalism, except for perhaps that On the Media piece, okay, where it was explained to people, to non-savvy insider-type people like me, okay, that sometimes reporters hear things that are damning and they don't report them.
No, actually, Tom Ricks, who is a former military reporter for the Washington Post, who wrote a very good book on the disaster of the Iraq War, more or less made the same point that beat reporters have a different kind of investment, and McChrystal should have known the difference between somebody coming in. And so they weren't the only ones, but they took it out, which was awfully suspicious, and then they explained that the reason was just to make the piece more readable, and that
it
was too long.
Yeah, right. I mean, on the web, you see, you had it been a print piece, I suppose we might have said, oh, we didn't have enough space on the front page, we need to take this off, but it wasn't.
Right. So what
you know, why can't we have a world? I've always, you know, I'm seen as sort of an outspoken person, and I wish I wasn't an outspoken person. I wish more people did speak out, and then I would just be an average person, right? I wish reporters didn't cover the asses of their sources, mm-hmm. and then we could see how the system would work itself out. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you know, the assumption is that if you don't, then you won't be able to call somebody up and find out, you know, is this story really true? But I'm not sure that that's right, because maybe you'd be able to do it in a world where people weren't getting their asses covered on a regular basis, just
right.
because somebody feels like people ought to know whether this is true or not.
Right.
You know?
So here's what I really think.
People would do the right thing, you know, without having their palms greased, you know?
If you never test it, you never know that. That's what
correct.
You're saying. Here's what I think
right.
really should happen, Dave. You should start out, let's say you're Politico or CNN, willing to cover the Pentagon or any other agency from the inside as a beat reporter. And if you determine through your attempts to report honestly on this institution that the institution is actually only willing to talk to you when they can present an image, and there really is no true transparency there, that the relationship is purely instrumental and managerial, then at a certain point, and you warn them, you tell them this.
Tell them
you're
what?
That you're going to switch to an outside-in role. In other words, start with the inside-out approach, and when you conclude, if you conclude, that it doesn't work, you switch to the outside-in approach, in which you report on the same institution, but you don't even try to get access. You don't try to show up and listen to their pitch. Instead, you try to figure out from the outside what's going on inside. And that would be a way to get the test that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it would proceed on sound journalistic principles. But I have no hope that they'll ever do this, because they want the inside contact. They like the feel of it.
You mean the reporters do?
Their bosses do. It's what Jamie McIntyre said is true. It says his bosses want him wired inside the Pentagon, and they want him to pay whatever price is required to keep that wire open.
Didn't you think it was over the top when they went to the barbecue at Joe Biden's house and they were shooting water guns at
There's
each other?
There's a lot of debate about that, yeah.
I think it was over the top.
Yeah, it was.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I think the White House Correspondents' Dinner is completely ridiculous, and I understand the arguments that journalists make for it, but it's indefensible.
Before we get to is his name Weigel?
Weigel.
Yeah, before we get to that, let's mm-hmm. let's switch over to the tech side for a minute.
Okay.
And talk about the W3C and HTML5.
Yeah.
It seems like it would be about as far afield as you could get.
But you say there's a connection.
But it's not.
Okay, so explain the story to it.
Well, because it's the flip side. It's the same thing, you know, except in a world where there's a pretense that it's not happening. I sent out a pointer to a piece written, I didn't take down the reporter's name, It was a CNET piece. I'll get it before.
Stephen Shankland.
There you go. It was a pretty interesting piece, and it just came out this morning, and I didn't even notice it in my feed until I was sitting here before the show, sort of, you know, doing a recap and thinking about what we ought to talk about. And I started reading the piece, and I was absolutely I was just fixated on it. It was a really fascinating story, because what this guy did was he went in, there's a division, right? You know, these standards, HTML5 is this thing that, you know, I've been hearing the hype about it, but not following the process at all. I'm way outside on this one. And everything I'd been hearing up till now was, oh, HTML5 is going to be wonderful. It does everything you'd ever want. You know, you should stop working on anything you're doing right now because HTML5 already does it. And you might, you know, forget it. Nothing you're doing matters.
Well, and it will replace Flash.
In addition to about right. everything else, too. Right. I mean, it's amazing. As I'm working on this new blogging tool, I can't tell you how many times people have said, well, there's really no point in doing this, whatever it is, because HTML5 already does it, right? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm an old-time guy, and I didn't believe any of that crap. I mean, there was a time when I would have been scared by that. You know, I would have thought, well, this is really... Because that's the purpose of that kind of stuff. It's supposed to scare you. It's supposed to make you think that you're just a small fry. You can't unless you're an insider on this, you can't possibly be there, you know. And all the while I'm thinking, you know, it can't possibly be as good as they're saying it is, right? Although it sure sounds really good. And then this article comes out and it shows, oh, well, there's two completely different groups, okay? And their specs don't agree. And one group was this independent group of developers, including people at Google. One guy in particular, Google's been working on this since 2003, okay? And
this is the W3C's HTML working group?
No, it's the other one.
Web Watt Hypertext group. Application
that's
working
right,
group?
That's not W3C.
Okay.
And they're apparently very far along. And the W3, it sounds to me from reading this piece, it sounds like they got almost to completion, and then somebody at the W3C said, we better get our stamp of approval on this thing, or else what? I don't know what else. I mean, this is the way that they think, you know. Microsoft thinks that way. Mozilla must have felt that way. I don't even know who, but it's just, I can't, I mean, I don't want to get dragged into this whole thing, and so I won't, like, it just is so familiar. In terms of, like, things get going, and then the wheels come in and try and... They try to stop the wheels.
Uh-huh.
And it's a fascinating thing to see. I don't know if there's anything much more to say about it.
Well, you know. What is the reason why we need these groups to complete their work?
Well, I don't really even know the answer to that question. I mean, you've got a bunch of different browsers out there, right? You know, the web came along. There was a spurt of innovation in the early 90s. One guy, Tim Berners-Lee, this is at least the myth. I don't really know the full story because I wasn't there. You know, working by himself, came up with this sort of hack on SGML, which was this pretty complicated language. What he did was took a human understandable subset of it, because he's one guy, right? Well, if he's one guy, then it can't be that complicated, because he's, you know, he's not even that technical necessarily, right? And he took that, and then he took a subset of TCP, which is the networking protocol that connects the two things, came up with HTTP and HTML, threw the two of them together, and wrote a piece of software called the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
And no working groups, no standards bodies,
mm-hmm.
absolutely nothing, and nobody paying any attention to it, mm-hmm. right? And all of a sudden, a few people tune into this, mostly academics,
right?
And they say, well, this looks pretty cool, let's do something with this, right? And so the mail list starts,
mm-hmm.
and among them was a guy named Mark Andreessen, a student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign,
mm-hmm.
and they pick it up, and NCSA and a few other quasi-government organizations pick it up, and pretty gradually the thing becomes kind of a juggernaut, right? Mm-hmm. And then the corporations get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that is when it all of a sudden starts getting really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the way it looks from my point of view.
Right.
And this seems to be a repeating process. And it sounds very much like, from the way this story is being told, you know, if you read between the lines, that it's the same, pretty much the same kind of thing. There was this one guy, Hickson, I think is his name, who's been writing the spec, and they don't like it that he's been writing it by himself. And he says, hey, if you can do a better job, why don't you do it? You know, if you think a group of you writing the spec can do a better job.
Right, in
you,
a committee.
Yeah,
right.
Why don't you go ahead and do it, you know, mm-hmm. instead of complaining about what I'm doing. And which sounds to me like a pretty reasonable thing to say. What I loved about this piece, though, Jay, mm-hmm. wasn't so much, I mean, I don't love the fact that this is happening. I mm-hmm. kind of really despise the fact that it's happening. What I love about this is that here's a reporter who actually wrote the story. That's what's amazing about it.
You mean he didn't sugarcoat it or try
well,
to...
Well, he might be sugarcoating it.
Cover
he,
over
you
the
conflict.
You can't
really tell. No, but this story never gets written.
Uh-huh.
The story never gets written as like, you know, here's what's... Here are... Here's the machinery stopping something from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And here... Actually, by the way, here are the names of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And remarkable
well,
piece of
reporting. That's journalism, right?
I think so. And I think that it's... And so much of it... You know how... You know, we talk about how when you read something in a report where you're an expert in the subject and you know that that isn't the way mm-hmm. it happened, the reporter got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the converse is also true. Sometimes you read a story and you go, that is so the way it works.
Uh-huh.
That I'm pretty sure he got it.
And right.
That's what I'm seeing in this story. So we'll have a link to this in the in the show notes. And I highly encourage everybody that's interested in, you know, the machinations of the tech industry and the politics of the tech industry, because that's really what you're looking at here.
Mm-hmm.
So take a look at this article, and if you're an insider on this one and you know something about what's going on, you know, let us know too and post a comment on that.
You know how I feel about stories like this, Dave? It's that there's this giant castle where the workings of power, you know, go on. And most of the time, the castle sends out, like, a show to entertain and quote-unquote inform us, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a production of the castle. and that's most of what news is.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, somebody finds a way to actually give you a window, like open a window, and you can look in.
Right.
You only get to look in at one little part of this huge edifice, right? But you actually get a view into something people are doing inside the castle.
Well, that's what blogging is supposed to be about, Jay. That's actually what we're, you know, that's, you know, I'm agreeing with you. It is wonderful when you see it. It's also remarkable that it comes from CNET, because CNET has been, when during the RSS period, CNET was doing the opposite.
Who owns CNET?
CBS.
Oh.
Yeah, it got bought by CBS. And the, guy, we could get him on the show.
We should have him on the show.
Dan Farber.
Yeah.
Dan Farber is an old friend of mine. I've known him for 25 years.
I'd like to get him on
the
show. So, Dan, if you're listening.
No, he's not listening. I promise you, he's not listening. But we could certainly get his attention. He's right here. He lives and works in New York now.
Let's get him.
Yeah. I mean, Dan is an interesting guy. And, yeah. So
plenty of questions.
So, let's talk about the Washington Post now, right?
Okay. So, something happened over the weekend that I consider to be huge not because the events themselves are so big, but because it's one of those events where very large tensions that are permanent and growing simply explode. So here's what happened. Well, let me back up. I've been trying in my last few posts at PressThink to explain to people in journalism that the only way they can solve the problem of ideology in the press is through transparency, meaning unless political journalism can shift from the view from nowhere to, look, here's where we're coming from. it's not going to be able to negotiate the passage into the rebooted system of news. This is my belief, and I've articulated it in many different ways over the years. So this week, something happened in that puzzle. And it starts several years ago when a young blogger named Ezra Klein, extremely talented young man, starts an email list, a mailing list, with other bloggers, journalists, and writers on the liberal left side of Washington politics so that they can understand each other and not just bash each other in blogs, right? Mm-hmm. And Joe Klein of Time Magazine helps him start it, and it grows from a few people who know each other to dozens, and then from dozens to hundreds, and it had 300 as of last week.
Are they
week.
Related, Ezra and Joe?
No.
No? Okay.
And
are you on this list?
I am not on the list, okay. And I've never been asked to be on the list. But it's come into the news a few times because conservatives found out about it and made a big deal out of it, claiming that it was some sort of secret coordinating device by which liberal journalists...
As if they don't have one themselves.
Right, by which liberal journalists control the news agenda.
Oh, right, I forgot. They control.
and this week, what happened is that Dave Weigel, who is a young blogger hired by the Washington Post to cover the conservative movement and the Tea Party movement, expressed over this private email list some frustration about Matt Drudge and other figures in the conservative movement who had kind of embarrassed him in various ways by invading his privacy and publishing photos of him at a wedding, and he said some incendiary things about figures in the conservative movement. And someone on the list, we don't know who, leaked these expressions of frustration to a politics kind of gossip site called Fishbowl DC. And Weigel had to apologize for them in his blog at the Washington Post. Then Daily Caller, which is a conservative-leaning new news organization, sort of along the lines of the Politico, run by Tucker Carlson, was given access to the archives of this list, went through them, and picked out some even more sensational tidbits that Weigel had written over the years and published them at the Daily Caller on Friday. And the frame that they gave it was suspicions confirmed. And it was all intended to show that Weigel had a kind of animus towards conservatives, although he was hired to be the Washington Post's beat reporter inside the conservative movement. And so the combination of the emails and the fact that he's the Washington Post reporter who's supposed to be inside the conservative movement confirmed for a lot of people on the right that, see, the liberal media is at it again. And as a result of the pressure from the first batch of emails and then the second, many of which, by the way, predated his being hired by the Washington Post, he offered his resignation on Friday morning, and the Washington Post accepted his offer, meaning they wanted to get rid of him. And then the blogosphere exploded for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. First is, it is supposed to be a private mailing list, even though everybody knows there are risks of leaks and from such a thing because 300 people are on it. Of course, it played into the existing culture war and tensions and complaints about the liberal media. But the most interesting part of it, and the part that made it a big story for me, is that one of the ways the Washington Post is trying to come to grips with my argument that it can't survive indefinitely on The View from Nowhere and it has to adjust to a world of blogging where people tell us where they're coming from is by hiring people like Ezra Klein and Dave Weigel. In other words, it's too difficult for them to face the issue squarely. It's too hard for them to actually debate it and decide it among themselves. If they did that, if they actually brought it up the way I bring it up in my PressThink posts and thought about it as an organization, they would implode. And so instead of doing that, the cost of that is too high. Instead, they kind of accommodate themselves piece by piece by hiring these bloggers who operate in a very different way. That Ezra Klein was a blogger for the American Prospect magazine before he joined the Washington Post. He's a liberal. He makes it very clear what he thinks a good solution to the healthcare crisis should be. He's also a total policy wonk. He knows the healthcare system and the bill as it moves through Congress backwards and forwards. He has institutional memory because he's been following this issue for a long time. He has a gift for understanding policy and for telling people about it. He's a very serious policy journalist in addition to being a blogger with attitude and style and opinion, right? Mm-hmm. And so they can't decide the big issue, but what they could manage to do was hire Ezra Klein because he really knows his stuff and give him a prominent place in the WashingtonPost.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the same thing with Weigel, who had distinguished himself as a reporter on the conservative movement. And he is not exactly a liberal. He's not a conservative either. He's, as one writer described him, a disaffected libertarian. But he made his views known. And so I considered it to be a very progressive and intelligent thing the Washington Post was doing. If it couldn't do what it really needs to do, which is confront the view from nowhere head on, it could at least try and adjust to the world of the web and the rebooted system of the news through hiring these young people who are not only extremely talented, but they're helping this old style newsroom and the print guys change without forcing their illusions to crash down upon them. And now they went, and not only did they get rid of him, but in explaining why they got rid of him, they actually sent their own understanding back about 10 years and said, we have to have people who are just reporters, not ideologues. Right. When actually what they need to do is mute this conflict and allow bloggers to develop at the Washington Post and bring the Washington Post into the 21st century. It was too much for them. When confronted with a crisis where they really had to now own their own strategy, they disavowed their strategy and went back to a kind of fundamentalism that the print guys, the baby boomers, the ones who grew up before the web and really don't particularly care for the web, wanted them to do. And so the reactionaries won. Culture war won, the print guys won, a pre-web understanding of journalism
Isn't
won.
It funny because I don't think they won.
Temporarily.
When we were discussing this before the show, I understand that from your point of view, this is a very big deal, right? From my point of view, it's something that's dead, acting very dead.
Mm-hmm.
I've not felt the Washington Post, no matter what they do with the bloggers, has, I hate to say it, I just don't think that I think I said it. I think I want to be careful.
Right.
I don't like saying things are dead. So I have, that's where I'm conflicted here, right?
Yeah.
I actually just said that it was, but
right. Well, I'm in the position of I criticize because I care.
Right, you care.
And I still see, some hope. At some point,
the New York Times did the same damn thing.
But they hired Nate Silver.
Yeah, they did. And let's see how that works out.
Nate Silver wrote a very intelligent column saying, look, I'm watching this closely because I'm in the same position that Weigel.
But I lost complete faith in them with the Maureen Dowd thing. That, for me, was the moment which I said, these guys are not serious about this.
Mm-hmm.
That was the moment when they should have fired both Maureen Dowd and their ombudsman for not doing the obvious thing.
This is when she took an idea from somebody else.
Literally plagiarized.
Yeah.
And they didn't... I mean, there was no question that was plagiarism.
10 seconds. Right?
Yeah.
And this is the end of the show, by the way, so we're out of time.
Once again, Dave, it's been fun rebooting the news with you.
Right on.
See you next week.
Okay.